Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, it's time to get an update on invasive plants in Wisconsin. A couple of guests for you. Mark Renz and Kelly Kearns are back with us. Mark's a professor and extension weed specialist with UW-Madison. He researches and gives information about the biology and management of invasive plants. And Mark, good to have you back.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I hope Kelly Kearns is as well. Kelly's the Invasive Plants Coordinator for the National Heritage Conservation Program of the Wisconsin DNR. Kelly, hi.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Yeah, great to have you with us. So we'll talk with these two about the Invader Crusader winners of 2020, invasive plants that are blooming now, and how the Safer at Home order has affected control efforts. So I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments as we move along today. The number is 800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. So June is Invasive Species Action Month, and among other things, that means the Wisconsin Invasive Species Council has announced the Invader Crusader winners for 2020. For those who aren't familiar, tell us about the Invader Crusader contest and then maybe what those awards and winners are all about.
Sure, I'll handle that one. So Invasive Species Awareness Month is a time when we try to get people to be familiar with invasive species and actually go out and take action. It's a good time to be identifying things in the field and to do some control work. And the Invader Crusader Awards are specifically a way to recognize people who've really kind of gone above and beyond and in doing that work, whether they're professionals or volunteers or organizations. And so their peers or people they work with nominate them. And this year we had a huge number nominated. I think we had over 25 different nominations come in. And so it's always a hard thing for the judges to figure out, you know, which ones actually deserve the best, you know, deserve to get the Invader Crusader Award. But we had six different professionals this time, one of which was an organization, the Golden Sands Resource Conservation Development District. Under the professional group, we had our first canine that was nominated and won. This is Cisco the dog and his handler, Chris Hammerla, who have done a tremendous amount of aquatic invasive species education and work together. So when Chris goes out to do his invasives work, then he takes Cisco along and gets a lot more attention because he's got Cisco along with him. They also have done a lot of videos together.
Oh, so that is very, very cool. Well, it's nice to recognize those folks for the work that they've done. Mark, can you update us on your lab and some of the research you've got going on?
Oh, we're doing a whole bunch of stuff now, too, Larry. You know, it's kind of tough. We kind of pride ourselves at being out in the field. It's a little bit harder to be out in the field and working with people. But we're continuing some of our efforts to predict future distribution of some of these invasive species and study control efforts on what's working well and what's not in managing these invasive species. And then really trying to get that information out to the public as best we can. It's a little bit more challenging in these times, but we're still trying our best. We've got a couple of really good websites. The First Detectors Network has some really good information, and our website for our lab, it's not that unique of a website URL. It's RenzWeedScience@cals.wisc.edu, but you can just Google Renz and Weed Science, and you can get a lot of that information. So lots of interesting stuff going on, and we're trying to keep busy in these challenging times.
Yeah, and before we go to the phones, I want to go back to Kelly for a minute. Tell us about the Natural Heritage Conservation Program.
So Natural Heritage Conservation is a part of DNR, and we basically are the folks that deal with all the rare species, the non-game species, those things that aren't hunted or fished, and all of the state natural areas throughout the state. There's almost 700 state natural areas around the state that are protected for their natural features. And then we also are kind of the home base for some of the invasive species work as well. And so we deal with the terrestrial, particularly in my program, we deal with the terrestrial invasive plants. And then we also have kind of coordination for the invasive species team throughout the department in our shop as well.
Well, I know you're involved with wild parsnip control, and I think Brooke in Ontario, Wisconsin, has a question about wild parsnip. Brooke, hi.
Yes, good morning, everyone. My question is I've got quite a problem with wild parsnip at my farm. And last year I mowed the pastures, and that really did a really good job in controlling it in the pasture. But I got some areas where it's just very difficult to mow. And I'm wondering, since it's blooming now, can I clip the flower heads off to not promote more spread?
Yeah, I can take that one, Larry. This is Mark. So, Brooke, you are not alone in this situation, unfortunately. Wild parsnip is abundant and just starting to flower in Wisconsin, and a lot of problems in various areas. So, first, mowing is a really good option, and the timing to mow is really critical, because if we can time it correctly, we can mow the plant once and viable seed will not be produced, and it will resprout and maybe even reflower, but it won't have enough time because we're so far north to produce viable seed. So if we can time that when not the flowers or inflorescences on the top of the plant, but the ones that come out after that one, the secondary or axillary inflorescences bloom, that is the best timing to mow, and that's really starting right about now in southern Wisconsin for a 2 to 3 week time frame. So for you and others, this is a perfect time to mow. If you mow before then, you're probably going to have to mow twice to prevent seed production, and if you mow after then, the problem is you might have some viable seed that you're spreading, so we don't want that to happen. But mowing is really good to control those in the pastures. Some of the animals will sometimes eat the wild parsnip as well, particularly if you're rotational and grazing. As far as those areas you can't mow, there's a range of other methods that do work. You mentioned clipping. That is effective, and the timing to do that would be similar to mowing. It's a little bit more challenging. You got to be concerned about that sap getting on your skin, because if that sap of that plant gets on your skin, it can cause a bad burn with blisters. So just be super careful when you're doing that to avoid that. And there's a range of other tools that you can do. If you can, clipping it as low to the ground as possible would be recommended. And to be honest, if you just have a few, I would just use a sharp shovel because that would help you distance yourself or your hands from it as well. And there are a range of other management methods that are available for wild parsnip. But I think clipping would be effective. The key is to prevent those seeds from being formed. If you can do that for 3 to 4 years consecutively and not have any seed coming in, you can eradicate it from your land. The challenge a lot of times is preventing that seed from coming in.
There's probably people wondering what wild parsnip even looks like.
Oh, Larry, that's, of course, a very intelligent follow-up. So if you see something that's yellow and starting to flower now and has an umbrella shape to those flowers, that's a really good indication of wild parsnip. If you look on the stems, they're highly ridged. Those are probably the top two identifying characteristics we see on a lot of our roadsides. I don't know, Kelly, is there anything else that we can tune in some of these people on what wild parsnip looks like over the phone?
Yeah, there's nothing else that's yellow and has an umbrella-shaped flower that should be blooming right now. We got to have a couple of native plants that are much smaller that bloom a little bit earlier in the year. So it should, if you see it growing on the roadsides and you're seeing those yellow umbrella flowers, that's parsnip.
All right, there you go, Brooke. Thank you so much, Lisa in Janesville. It's your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I'm not sure if this is an invasive weed or a natural weed, but for about 3 years now in my shade garden at the edge of my woods, it's a plant that has a very shallow root system and it has a very watery stalk, but tends to grow pretty high. And at some point it will develop a small orangish type flower, and it is spreading everywhere.
So sounds like you've got jewelweed. Jewelweed is a very, very common native plant found in shaded areas. It's an annual, so it's super easy to pull out, and that's by far your best way to deal with it, is hand pulling it before, ideally before it flowers, and at least before it sets seed. The seeds are in little pods that pop when they're ripe, and so if you wait too long, you're just going to be letting those seeds pop all over your yard. And so you need to go in now or even a little bit earlier in the year and just pull all those things up, put them in your compost, and keep doing that every year and try to get every plant. And again, you won't have the seed set, and therefore you'll eventually decrease the number that are there.
All right. There you go, Lisa. Thank you so much for calling. And Mo in Oconto, your turn. Hi, Mo.
Hey, here's what I have. I have stinging nettles, and they're kind of interspersed in my raspberry patch and, of course, other areas on the property. But how can I get rid of those guys? And I kind of want to avoid using too much poison because they're in with the raspberries, but they seem to be growing, not going away.
Yeah, Mo, those stinging nettles can be really difficult. Kelly, is stinging nettles native or non-native? I think it's native. I'll get confirmation.
Yeah, there's some taxonomic confusion about that, but it's probably the native one that he has.
Yeah, so leave it to botanists to make things confusing, and I am a botanist, so I can say that. But these stinging nettles are really weedy, and they can be troublesome. You know, the biggest issue for others, and Mo, unfortunately, it sounds like you've experienced this, is that they do have these hairs that are like they're needles that like inject a toxin that can cause some bad reactions to a lot of individuals. So we want to be really careful when handling those plants. They are perennials, and so that's what makes them challenging to manage, particularly when you have raspberries interspersed. And it can become challenging because few pesticides are recommended or registered for this situation. So I think really your best advantage in that situation, Mo, is I would put in lots of mulch. I'm talking 3 to 4 inches of mulch. Straw mulch would work great. And when those stinging nettles come through, and they will come through, the options would be, my primary option, what I would do is try to put on like maybe some really, really heavy gloves and try and pull as much of it out from the soil as you can. You could potentially try and get a solution of glyphosate and just really carefully just paint it onto the leaves if you just have a couple. But there's no real easy way to manage it in those settings where you have like those raspberry brambles coming up everywhere. It's really a challenge.
There you go, Mo. Thanks very, very much. Well, Kelly, you were going to add something.
Yeah, one other option for trying to get that glyphosate directed onto the leaves is what's called the glove of death, where you put on a rubber glove first, and then you put a very cheap cotton glove on top of that, and you spray the herbicide into your glove, and then you swipe the stems. And then that should get enough of the herbicide onto the leaves themselves that it'll translocate it into the root system. But again, you'll want to get it on as many of the stems as possible. And that should be able to get it on the nettles without it affecting the raspberries.
There you go, Mo. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's take a call from Andy in Madison. Hi, Andy.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I have a question about herbicides. I work for a not-for-profit locally, and I do a lot of herbicide application to reed canary grass along, it's in natural areas, like along riparian zones. And I'm trying to, you know, spray it without impacting the aquatic life. And I'm just wondering, are there any grass-specific herbicides that are aquatic-approved?
Oh, yeah, Andy, that's a great question. And it's a very complicated question. To my knowledge, there are no grass-specific herbicides that are yet to be registered for aquatic use. I know that there are several ones that that we have been evaluating and others have. And so there is potential for future registration of some of those products. But to my knowledge, none of them are currently registered for use in aquatic situations. But you really have to read the label carefully because sometimes some of those products, and I'm not certain on those, will say up to the water's edge. So really reading that label carefully to make sure you're following those restrictions is critical. I will say, and I'm sure, Andy, you're aware of this, is if you are making any application in a wetland or aquatic situation, you need to be certified in the aquatic category for Wisconsin pesticide applicator training and certification, as well as be using certified aquatic herbicides. So there are some that are on the horizon, but to my knowledge, in Wisconsin, we do not have any grass-specific aquatic mm-hmm. herbicides.
And we'll be talking some more about aquatic invasive species at around 11:45 today on the Ideas Network. Kelly Kearns, Invasive Plants Coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR, Mark Renz, Professor and Extension Weed Specialist with UW-Madison, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at controlling invasive plant species on the show today with Kelly Kearns of the Wisconsin DNR, Mark Renz of the UW-Madison, our guest today. Join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. And Katie in Burlington has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I just wanted to give this idea, and maybe you guys can veto it, but a friend of mine came up with what I thought was a really great idea for how to get rid of invasives. So what, because I've had buckthorn in my backyard, and then I'd be spraying all this brush and whatever, brush killer, and I just felt like I was getting so much of it, and then I'd probably get it on my skin or whatever. But he said, get like those bingo markers that have like a little spongy top to them, and then I put the brush or weed killer in that, and then I cut the plant, and then I just dab on that the top of the stem. And so I'm hardly using any pesticides or brush killer. It's keeping it very concentrated only on the spot that I want, and it's really been effective.
All right.
So
well,
hopefully I described that.
Yeah, I think you did. Kelly, what do you think?
Yeah, that actually, I'm sorry to tell you that you're not the first person that's come up with that. It is actually something that a lot of people have been using. The other, so those bingo markers are basically like a plastic container that have a sponge on the end. And those work pretty well. The other system that works well for a lot of people is there's these things you can get for washing dishes that also have a plastic kind of reservoir and then a sponge on the end as well. The main thing you need to be concerned about those is when you're dabbing them on a cut stem, then usually they can get kind of ripped up. So, you know, figure out which one works best for you as far as having a strong enough sponge that doesn't get ripped up. There's a number of different techniques like this that people have used to really target the herbicide onto a stem. And anything that you can do to minimize the overspray is really helpful. There's also some folks that have come, a guy in Minnesota who's come up with a system that actually creates a foam. And so that foam actually, you know, sticks right on the stem and doesn't spray all over. And, several really good systems like that.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks
yeah,
again.
Larry,
yeah, go ahead,
if I
Mark.
I could just add one thing. I mean, Kelly's spot on, and Katie, I think I'm glad that you discovered this technique. The one thing you do need to worry about with this technique is if you're treating a lot of those stems, you are using a concentrated solution that's 20 to 40% of the pure concentrate. So if you're treating hundreds or thousands of stems, you can actually exceed the allowable amount of active ingredient that you can apply to a particular area. So you need to be careful about if you're doing large-scale treatment with a lot of these that you're not over-applying, because then you could be breaking the label. But in general, I agree with Kelly. It's a great technique. It's really specific, and you can limit that off-target herbicide deposition in the environment.
Yeah. Christy in Chippewa Falls has a buckthorn question, I bet, as well. Christy, did that help you?
That's a good reminder. I've seen that done working at Maiden Rock Bluff with
Mike Eden. And anyway, but my buckthorn question is, so I'm removing females in a heavily invested area, and so far the berries are green, but how much time do I have before those berries become viable seeds? I imagine it's looking at the color.
I don't know if anyone has actually done that research to look at when buckthorn seeds become viable. Certainly once they turn dark, then they probably are. I would say the best thing to do would be to cut open some of the seeds and look at them and see if they look like they have a viable embryo in there. Mark, do you have any ideas?
Yeah, I think one of the tricks that I've learned from my agronomic friends and colleagues is if you can cut open those berries and if you can take your fingernail and if you can kind of pierce those seeds with your fingernail, that's an indication that it's still immature and it's very unlikely to become mature. But once that starts to harden and it becomes difficult to break those seeds in there, that's when it's going to be viable. A lot of factors can depend on that. And I agree with Kelly. I don't think anyone's researched it, at least not that I'm aware of. You probably have some time. How much time, you know, I could make a guess, but that's what it would be, I guess. So I think you got definitely a couple weeks, but maybe not much more than that.
There you go, Christy. Thank you again for calling. Carolyn in Pewaukee, on to you now. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. First time I've called in. Very happy to talk to you. I have a we have a large property, which a lot of it is in wetland wet prairie, and I had a piece of the yard that I'm converting, which I tried last year, and I thought I had killed a lot of it. I had rounded up a lot of it, and then I had interplanted it with native prairie plants. But this year, there is a ton of Canada thistle in it, and so I'm looking for a way to get rid of it. I've tried pulling it, but then I've read that if you pull it, you end up with two pieces instead of one. I've also read that you can cut it very low, or you can try glyphosate, or I think 2,4-D, but I'm not sure what, it's just kind of overwhelming because it's a pretty large area. I'm looking
Canada
for the
thistle's a really tough one to kill, if I'm not mistaken. Kelly,
yeah,
comment?
It is.
Or Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, we've done a lot of work, Carolyn, in this area, and it's really an interesting beast, particularly in these restoration prairies. How big of an area are we talking about that you're working on? Is it acres? You know, hundreds of feet? What are we talking about?
Maybe it's like a large. We have 22 acres, but this is just a small part. This is maybe as big as not that big, maybe okay. 100 by 100 feet or something. So
okay, and then is this newly reseeded within the last year or two, or has this been seeded many years ago?
I seeded it like last year, but then I interplanted it. I have native plants other place, so I've just been transplanting things from my own yard where areas that killed well, I transplanted things from other parts of my yard, Joe Pye weed and ironweed and things like that, that are doing pretty well. Pimstamen, those are all doing well, but then there's thistle around them.
Yeah. So. Well, first I want to, say you're doing a great job. It's great that you're actively restoring this area and putting some of these native plants and hopefully returning some of the functionality of this system. Canada thistle is a real interesting one in that we've had it in Wisconsin for literally hundreds of years, and it goes through these ebbs and flows. Populations will build up, and then there's actually now diseases that will suppress it in the environment. Often you'll see the tips of it turn white. That's a bacteria that can infect it. But Larry's also correct. It is a tough one. It's got these creeping perennial roots, which can be really challenging to manage. So in this prairie system, kind of there's been quite a bit of work the last 10 years, and we kind of come to the conclusion that as long as you can keep those populations low, and I'll give you an idea of what I mean by low, the impact is pretty minimal of Canada thistle. So we just want to keep them in check, and as that prairie continues to develop, and you stop adding disturbance by, like, you know, tilling the soil, digging something up or other things, a lot of times that canna thistle just goes away or becomes just a very small component. So kind of the rule of thumb, but if it gets the populations get high enough, it can prevent the establishment of some of these good guys that you want to get going. So kind of the rule of thumb is we want to keep that cover well below 30%. So if you're looking out, you know, a lot of ways, if you're in a big area, I say if you take 100 steps, if 30 of those steps land on a canna thistle plant, that's 30% cover. So you want to try, and it sounds like you have probably right around that threshold or close to it. So I would try and do some management. I think you can start, you know, with mowing the plants before they produce seed. Or if it's small enough, you could take clippers and just clip off the stems. If you wanted to, when you clipped off the stems, dab a little bit of Roundup or glyphosate on those and be very careful. That would help. But I think just some type of moderate management should be all that you need. And then keep on monitoring it. See if that works. Because the challenge is you have all this good stuff in there, and it's really difficult to come up with a recommendation you could apply to the whole area that wouldn't harm some of the beneficial species. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be my advice. If you want some more specific information, you can email me, and I can give you some of our research results.
And thanks very much for calling. Anne emailed that she has 330 acres of woodland and meadows in Dunn County, and prickly ash is invading everywhere. Why is this happening, and what should she do? Kelly, do you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. So prickly ash is a native species that's clonal, meaning that it's spreading from underground root systems. And so if you knock it back in part of the clone, but you don't get all of it, then it's just going to keep growing. And it typically comes in areas that have been grazed in the past, but that the grazing animals have been taken off of the landscape. And so a lot of the prickly things come up after grazing. And so there's a couple of things that can be done. If it's an area you're trying to get back into forest, then eventually the shade will knock back the prickly ash if you get enough good canopy cover in there. If you don't have that option, then they're probably using some kind of an herbicide that would be, again, that cut stem and dab the stems with the herbicide would probably be the most effective way to get after that. You'd need to use a systemic herbicide. So something like a glyphosate would work on that, but a triclopyr is usually used for woody species. And so in this case, that probably would be the best. No, Mark, do you have any other suggestions besides triclopyr and glyphosate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the key is it sounds like you have a lot of it. And so developing a plan of how you can approach that, there's a range of herbicides that are effective and methods of application. And since it's clonal, a lot of times we don't want to do the cut surface treatment, because that encourages those perennial roots to resprout. And so there's other treatment methods. And so if you just have a couple, I would say, you know, cut surface and lots of monitoring. But if you have a lot of it, I would ask for some help from some local individuals, either foresters. I know we have a really good invasive species management team that you can contact in Dunn County to get some help on developing a plan. Because if there's a lot, it's going to take a long-term plan that takes, you know, multiple years to get control. And it's a tough one. It is a challenge. It's in lots of our forests. And even though it's native, not very many people like it. I can say that. Anyone that's brushed up against it will know what I'm talking about. So you're not alone in this. I'd encourage you to seek some help from a conservationist or someone else. And if you have trouble getting a hold of someone, let me know, and I'd be happy to put you in contact with someone in that county that can help you.
And the foresters, the county foresters, are they typically located in the county offices?
It can vary, I think. And so I think the key is I would encourage you to contact your local county extension or your conservation department. Kelly, don't you think those would be probably the best first steps in communication?
Right. And, you know, but if you're working specifically in a forest, then, you know, DNR foresters might be a good step as well. So looking up on the DNR website who the forester would be in your county.
Let's take another call. Marcus and Adams, it's your turn. Hi, Marcus.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you were talking about applying Roundup with the dabber and stuff, and I just wanted to mention that Roundup actually makes a gel, and it looks like a deodorant stick, actually, but it's a little more target-specific to the plants. But then you can also, if you have a Roundup mixture, you can buy it. It looks like a small milk carton. It's called wallpaper paste mixture, and if you mix it in, it'll actually make that same gel that you can apply, and it works really well with stinging nettles. But just,
oh, so, yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks, Marcus. You guys comment on that?
Mark? Yeah, that's a really, really neat observation, and it's always I'm always find it really interesting when people come up with these approaches. I think the challenge with pesticides, and so this is the bad news of this session here, is that any type of application needs to be assessed and approved by EPA and our Department of Ag. And so while that seems like it's worked really well for you, Marcus, and seems like a really viable option, it's actually an off-label use of glyphosate, believe it or not. We've had this same issue where often people are mixing in windshield wiper fluid with glyphosate to treat when temperatures go below freezing. And reports are we've had that be very successful, but that is officially been designated as an off-label application. So this is where all the regulations get really complicated in it. So I want to commend you on your out-of-the-box thinking, but just remind you that these pesticides are regulated very tightly for good reasons.
Karen emailed wondering about creeping bellflower. How can she eradicate it? She's kept it from going to seed, tried digging it out for years, herbicides she used, smothering with cardboard, and they still come back. She's wondering what works for creeping bellflower.
Well, I think Mark has a good story on that one and how he's dealt with it in his property.
Mark? Yeah, I mean, so the best advice I would have would be move, because it's just a really, really challenging plant. I do have it in my yard in Madison, and I do manage it and do exactly some of the things you say. And I have been able to eradicate it from one very small area. It's about a 1 square meter area surrounded by cement. I basically removed and excavated all the soil 1 foot down, sifted through the soil, took out all the perennial roots, and then put the soil back in, and I've eradicated it from that 1 square foot. The bad news is that it's everywhere else in all my other flower beds. So it sounds like you're doing some of the right things. There are some herbicides that work better than others, but that's a tough one.
What does it look like?
Yeah, and so this is one that has these heart-shaped leaves. You'll see it really common in a lot of the flower beds. It does have these creeping root systems, and the roots actually can be quite large when you dig them up from the soil, too. It will have these purple, blue, well, I'm colorblind, so Kelly, you describe the flower color because I'll get it wrong.
Yeah, so the flowers are bell-shaped, and they are maybe half an inch in size, 5 petals. And there are multiple flowers up the raceme, and so they get the plant gets smaller and smaller as it goes up. One of the problems with this plant is when you pull it, it's fairly fragile right at the point where the plant connects to the root system in the ground, and so it's super easy to pull them, but you only get the top. You don't get the roots at all, and so the roots actually, if you dig down deep, you may find huge tubers. And so it is really difficult to do long-term control without digging them up or using a systemic herbicide. You know, but on the short term, you know, being able to just pull up every stem, that's what I do in my yard. Unfortunately, they're extremely common in urban areas.
Hmm. That is that's too bad. Alicia emailed to ask about wood avens. It seems to be taking over in Duluth, Minnesota. What can she do about this invasive? Wood avens?
Boy, I'm not real familiar with that species.
Yeah,
I don't know that species very well. There are several different avian species that seem to be somewhat invasive. I don't really know much about how that can be controlled or why it might be spreading.
Steve emailed to ask if reed canary grass is an invasive or just aggressive or unwanted. Also, at what point does one accept the do of things like prolific seeding, uncontrolled dispersal by birds, aggressive rhizomes, superior fitness, etc., that invasive organisms, which was introduced to a region, is not going anywhere and may as well be considered a new natural in the environment?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one, and there's some new data that's just coming out of Minnesota and elsewhere where now some people are contending that it's native, not invasive. And so the definition of invasive is that it was brought over and it was not by pre-European settlement in the United States. And so there's some new data that is suggesting that it actually is native to the upper Midwest, Minnesota and Wisconsin, not non-native. We clearly have brought germplasm over. We plant it as a forage crop, but much of these populations, some of the new data suggests it's native. What the true answer is, I don't know. They haven't published these data. This is just a brand new blurb I saw yesterday. So it's questionable if we should call it invasive or not, but it sure is aggressive and weedy and has lots of impacts. And so the challenge is how do we manage it? And I think really the key is he alluded that we really got to pick our battles. Where it's widespread and already there, we need to decide, are we going to manage it? Because it's going to take a lot of time, energy, and resources. And then that's likely going to involve replanting and restoration. We have lots of examples of success of that, but it takes time and energy and resources. So trying to pick your battles, where to manage it, is truly a challenge. And in some areas, particularly where we have high eutrophication or lots of nitrogen and phosphorus present, maybe it's better to leave that because it's keeping that phosphorus and nitrogen from moving offsite. I don't know. Kelly, you have some thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the problems with reed canary grass is that it was intentionally planted at a very large scale back in the 1930s for erosion control. And so that's why it's so widespread around the state. It's probably our most abundant invasive plant in the state as far as the number of acres that it covers. You know, where it gets into a wetland or even into a wet forest or even some of the upland areas, it can completely dominate. And so it is a very difficult plant to control. We actually have a very large publication that goes into all the details about controlling this, that if people would like to order that publication, they can send an email to invasive.species@wisconsin.gov, and we can get that out to you. And it kind of helps you go through kind of your situation and what might be the best in your situation. In many places, people have just decided it's not worth the effort trying to control it. One thing that is good about it is that it does hold the soil along streams. It, you know, pretty much the vast majority of streams in southern Wisconsin have reed canary lining their banks, and it does hold that soil well.
You know, you mentioned the website invasive.species@wi.gov, and giant hogweed, I know, that has a terrible effect on your skin as well. And there are some native look-alike plants, and how do you tell the difference? Can we find that on the invasive.species website?
So the invasive.species is an email that you send your photos to.
Of course.
You can go to the DNR website for more information on hogweed. Probably the easiest thing to do is just Google giant hogweed versus lookalikes, and you'll find all sorts of really great fact sheets. And in general, hogweed is very large, 7 to 14 feet when it's flowering usually. The flowers themselves are multiple of these white umbrella type flowers at the top that can be altogether up to 2.5 feet across and have many, many rays in those umbrellas. And the umbrellas themselves are fairly flat topped. The other thing to look for is very large leaves with deeply incised lobes and with sharp margins, with pointy margins. And then the stems themselves on the flowering stems usually are at least 2 inches wide in diameter, and they have purple blotches with white hairs. And especially at the node where the leaf emerges off of the stem, there's a ring of white hairs. So if you look at those things, and if you see something that has those characteristics, please send us photos and tell us where you saw these. Right now, we only know of a few populations in Wisconsin, and they're all being managed. And so we get a lot of reports on giant hogweed every year this time of year, and almost all of them are either cow parsnip or angelica, which are two of our native species. So if you think that it might be hogweed, please go ahead and send that email in to invasive.species@wisconsin.gov with some decent photos, and we'll be able to help you figure that out.
There we go. Well, on that note, we need to close out here. Kelly and Mark, thank you both so much. Kelly Kearns, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
She's the invasive plants coordinator for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program with the Wisconsin DNR. And Mark Renz, thank you as well.
My pleasure, Larry. It's great hearing your voice again. Hopefully I can see you soon.
I hope so, too. Mark's a professor and extension weed specialist with UW-Madison. Great to have both of them with us. We're going to turn our attention next to the many lakes, streams, and wetlands in Wisconsin that are in danger from both plant and animal invaders. That next. I'm Larry Mehler.